I know you wanted me away, but I am called to be the first pope from the USA. And I heard that there's a special place where God talks directly to me every time I pray. I'm having holy dreams of ruling the Holy See. Here's Santa Monica, her son is calling me. Won't make the bishops proud, the USCCB. We'll see their bro in Christ. I know they're gonna scream. God, what will you do? You once were a boy, then you went to Peru, oh father. I'm on the balcony in my vestments. They elected me as the woke Marxist Pope. I'm pontificating as the woke Marxist Pope. I'll be treading closer to the old status quo. Bigots will keep calling me the woke Marxist Pope. Woke Marxist Pope.
Woke Marxist Pope.
Oh no.
Oh yes, Michael. That was Instagrammer, TikToker, and YouTuber The Real Cody Webb singing a parody of Chapo Roan's Pink Pony Club, written by Tumblr Runaway Marbles about...
Let me guess, about the newly elected Pope, Pope Leo XIV, formerly Cardinal Robert Francis Prevost?
Exactly.
Leo XIV's first papal address to the crowds gathered in St. Peter's Square called for peace and unity.
Aiutateci anche voi.
And you too. Help us, and then help one another. To build bridges through dialogue, through encounters, uniting all of us to be one people, always in peace.
As you heard from this clip from Germany's DW News, the crowd seems to adore Leo because he appears to continue the legacy of Pope Francis, who criticized capitalism and famously took a more ambiguous stance on homosexuality in the Catholic Church.
If a person is gay and seeks God and has goodwill, who am I to judge him?
Yes, Francis's reply, "Who am I to judge?" signified a tone shift that represented greater tolerance, if not openness, to Catholic gays and lesbians. I heard that while serving under Pope Francis, our new pope softened his hardline stances against the homosexual lifestyle and greater representation of gays and lesbians in media, by allowing bishops to be flexible on how they engage gay parishioners.
Yes, but if you listen closely to the lyrics of Woke Marxist Pope, some think this new pope will slowly return the church to the legacy of Pope Benedict, formerly Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, who took a decidedly anti-gay stance during the early AIDS crisis.
Those comments really mattered, Summer, because it split Catholics against each other by putting one theological principle, caring for the poor, against another theological principle, the power of patriarchy in religious practice. It led to most people thinking that to stand with the church meant standing against people with AIDS.
Exactly. Recent comments by Leo affirming that marriage is only between one man and one woman connect his ideas to conservative ideas. Instead of woke Marxist Pope, maybe the lyric should be changed to homophobic Marxist Pope.
Then it would be a little bit harder to sing, wouldn't it?
Yes. Hi, I'm Summer Benbrook.
And I'm Michael O'Neill. And we'd like to officially welcome you to the second season of The Other Streets of Philadelphia. In our first season, we focused on all the people erased and made invisible by the early emphasis on AIDS being a white gay man's disease. We learned in the first season how black activists, feminists, queer people of color, and harm reductionist activists all fought against the common narrative that the only people who got AIDS were white gay men.
This season, we're switching things up a bit by examining another false myth about the early AIDS crisis. We'll be looking at many of the same communities we examined in our first season, but from an angle emphasizing faith-based activists. In this season, we're challenging the notion made popular by religious leaders like Ratzinger that standing with the church meant standing against people with AIDS. We hope to uncover how standing against people with AIDS overtly meant defending racism, patriarchy, homophobia, and classism.
We'll be using oral history testimonies from the Philadelphia AIDS Oral Histories Project. It's a project made possible by the great folks at the William Way LGBT Center's John Wilcox Archives here in Philadelphia. All of our episodes were made by students like us, enrolled in a research class at Drexel University, taught by Professor Nick John Ramos, called The History of the AIDS Pandemic.
I can't wait.
Neither can I. Let's begin. Our first episode, titled Exploring Gay Conservatism, features our series hosts, Thais, Cam, and Morgan, reading quotes from Michael Flynn and other sources. It focuses on how Ratzinger's leadership, along with other conservative Catholic leaders, impacted AIDS activist efforts in Philadelphia.
In December of 1989, something happened in New York City. About 4,500 people protested outside St. Patrick's Cathedral in one of the boldest protests of the AIDS crisis.
Cardinal O'Connor made an amazing series of statements, which can be summarized in four words, and this is not an exaggeration. Let them get AIDS.
It was called Stop the Church. It was led by ACT UP, the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, and WHAM, the Women's Health Action Mobilization Group. The protest targeted the Catholic Church's harmful role in public health, especially its rejection in abortion rights, condoms, and LGBTQ rights.
We must put out the message that we are the ones who are fighting for people's lives, and they are the murderers.
Stop the church! Stop the church! Stop the church!
While thousands protested outside, about 100 went inside the church during Mass. They laid on the floor in a die-in to represent the lives lost to AIDS. One man crumbled a communion wafer in front of the congregation, which was a move that shocked the public and outraged the church.
Inside, Cardinal O'Connor is busy spreading his lies and rumors about the position of lesbians and gays. We're here to say we want to go to heaven too.
To the protesters, this wasn't about disrespecting religion. It was about survival. They believed Cardinal O'Connor's public influence was costing lives. The reactions were intense. Media coverage focused more on the shock factor than the reasons behind the protests. Although, for ACT UP, it was a powerful way to say, silence equals death.
Stop killing us! Stop killing us! Stop killing us! We're not gonna take it anymore! You're killing us! Stop it! Stop it! Stop it! Stop it! Stop it! Stop it! Stop it!
We're fighting for your lives too! We're fighting for your lives too!
Michael Flynn opposed the protests because of his Christian beliefs. He admitted,
O'Connor is no friend of ours. He's authoritarian, rigid, and remote. But as a Christian, Flynn argued, I believe he deserves to be treated in the same way we demand to be treated, with respect and dignity. I also believe that a church service should never be a place to vent hatred.
For Flynn, the church was by definition a place set apart from politics and hatred, and the protesters trampled over this important division.
To see unbalanced miscreants ridicule the faithful's beliefs, mock the churchgoer's feelings, and desecrate the most sacred element of Catholic worship, a consecrated host, is sickening and repulsive.
Flynn disagreed with how Stop the Church was done, but others felt it was the only way to be heard. This showed the deep divide in how people reacted to AIDS and the church's role in responding to the virus.
To understand how we got here, we have to go back to the beginning, when AIDS first appeared and most people chose to ignore it.
A mystery disease known as the gay plague has become an epidemic unprecedented in the history of American medicine. That today from the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, topping the list of likely victims are male homosexuals who have many partners and drug users who inject themselves with needles. Medical experts say the disease kills 4 out of every 10 people it strikes and that it threatens to explode in the nation's cities.
On June 5th, 1981, the CDC reported the first documented case of AIDS in 5 men. Quote, all active homosexuals, unquote, admitted to hospitals in L.A. At the time, it was identified as a form of pneumonia, later as a gay cancer, and then as gay-related immune deficiency, or GRID, and even later as HIV/AIDS. Soon, medical researchers, politicians, and the media all began to portray AIDS as a rich white gay man's disease, something that Michael himself believed at first.
I thought it was rich, white, well, not even rich, but these gay guys who partied all night and all day in New York and Los Angeles, because that's where we first heard about it. Larger news was picking up, you know, these homosexuals who lived a high life, and they were coming down with this very strange sort of cancer.
The belief that AIDS was a gay disease activated gay and lesbian community organizations to be some of the first to respond. Information about AIDS and sexual health was distributed mostly among white, middle-class gay men, especially during the early epidemic. Consequently, straight society believed in the idea of a gay-only disease, and they believed it eagerly.
When AIDS first cropped up about 18 months ago, almost all its victims were homosexual males who frequently changed sexual partners. Alarming enough to that particular segment of society, but, so it first appeared, not threatening to the public at large. But that seems to be changing, and the disease may be spreading.
That was a clip from an ABC News broadcast on the 17th of December, 1982. But AIDS wasn't just a gay disease. Among those who died at the highest rates were poor people, black people, sex workers, and drug users, many of them gay, and many others not. The disease was communicable through direct contact with blood and bodily fluids, though it was expected to be transmittable in other ways until this discovery was confirmed by the CDC in 1983. Even afterwards, though, people avoided touching or being near anyone with AIDS under the assumption that the disease would spread. Many doctors avoided treating AIDS patients, and many churches rejected the sick, not only due to the idea that the disease would spread, but due to the idea that those who got AIDS were sinners, homosexuals, addicts, or prostitutes that deserved their condition. Jerry Falwell, founder of right-wing fundamentalist organization Moral Majority, framed AIDS as a warning against the sexual revolution of the 60s and 70s.
AIDS is not just God's punishment for homosexuals, it is God's punishment for the society that tolerates homosexuals.
Despite the urgency of this health emergency, President Reagan only acknowledged the existence of AIDS in 1985, having his first major speech in 1987. The first reported case of AIDS was, again, in 1981.
Ronald Reagan has made his first major speech on AIDS. Reagan is ordering the AIDS test for all federal prisoners and potential immigrants. He also wants to see routine testing at sex disease and drug abuse clinics.
Innocent people are being infected by this virus, and some of them are going to acquire AIDS and die. I've asked the Department of Health and Human Services to determine as soon as possible the extent to which the AIDS virus has penetrated our society and to predict its future dimensions. I've also asked HHS to add the AIDS virus to the list of contagious diseases for which immigrants and aliens seeking permanent residence in the United States can be denied entry.
By 1986, over 12,000 Americans had died of AIDS. Even with the tremendous amounts of dead, what made the AIDS epidemic so easy for people to ignore? Through the 70s and 80s came the rise of the New Right and the Christian Right. With this resurgence of religious fundamentalism, two dominating narratives emerged: the narratives of privacy rights and religious freedom. These two frameworks offered a way for both liberal and moderate AIDS activists to defend the rights of gay people and PWAs, or people with AIDS, and a way for the religious right to justify rejecting and ignoring the mass death of people they deemed undesirable during a time where gay people were gaining more and more public visibility. As the gay rights movement persisted, many activists and openly gay figures even urged other gay people to come out, including San Francisco Mayor Harvey Milk in his speech at DeLongpre Park in 1978.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you. I'm tired of listening to the Anita Bryans twist the language of the Bible to fit their own distorted outlook. But I'm even more tired of the religious leaders of this nation who know it and remain silent. I'm tired of their silence.
The right to sexual privacy was a framework used, on one hand, by many LGBT reformists arguing for anti-discrimination laws and the elimination of laws banning same-sex sex. Alongside the surge of the religious right, gay culture and pro-gay regional and national organizations surged too, following organizing from the 60s. Dignity USA, which Flynn volunteered with in Philadelphia, was one of these national orgs, among other orgs like Lambda Legal and National Gay Task Force. These groups, as observed by scholar and activist Mark Stein in Rethinking Gay and Lesbian Movement, were centralized rather than grassroots and often headed by suburban, normative white gay people. These orcs also, quote,
tended to utilize arguments around minority and privacy rights rather than sexual liberation and social revolution. These were effective strategies for winning public support, but not for promoting mass mobilization and radical transformation.
Leadership were.
Straight office seekers have become so convinced of the power of the gay vote that for the first time in any congressional primary, a liberal Democratic candidate, Barbara Boxer, sent out campaign literature specifically targeted at gays.
Privacy rights-based advocacy, while not bringing about radical change, did achieve many wins in decriminalizing homosexuality, as straight moderate and some conservative suburbanites saw this approach as protecting their common interests, without having to condone gay people publicly. This could be seen with San Francisco's Alice B. Toklas Club, which was a group of gay Democrats that advocated for legal protections for gay people. They eventually helped secure California's consenting adult sex law in 1975, which decriminalized private consensual gay sex. However, the Catholic Church and religious right utilize arguments around privacy in a different way, which Michael describes firsthand.
The Catholic Church is very patriarchal. We believe misogynistic. One of the reasons why Dignity was founded is because the way that the Catholic Church wants other Catholics to live is steeped in the 1940s.
The same framework of sexual privacy was used by conservative religious groups to exclude and discriminate against gay people. The religious right demanded that gay people stay out of public sight, either refusing to discuss gay sex acts or openly condemning their existence as an affront to God. This next clip from 1988 features White House Communications Director Pat Buchanan debating AIDS policy on CNN Crossfire.
Now why don't we go at it this way? I didn't see a word in there about closing down all bathhouses, porn theaters, gay bars, where this kind of promiscuous sodomy is commonplace, and everybody in the police force knows which ones they are. Why don't they go at it that way? I mean, you seem to be protecting an individual's right to privacy, I mean, even when he's a tremendous risk to the community.
Buchanan was quoted in 1981 saying that AIDS was nature's revenge on gay men. Until it became clear that AIDS affected everyone, not just gay men, AIDS was seen in the mainline Catholic Church as a consequence of sinful, promiscuous, and homosexual behavior, thus undeserving of treatment. Progressive narratives surrounding religious freedom were also used by the religious right to defend their discrimination practices. They believed banning discrimination based on sexuality or gender expression would be a violation of the state upon the individual's right to discriminate based on their personal views, which is still argued by many religious conservatives today. Narratives of the oppressed versus oppressor are flipped on their heads to reinforce the disenfranchisement of LGBT people. This artificially reversed dynamic can be seen in this next clip of current Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, as she comments on New York's school pronoun policies.
You have young minds. They're saying, we're going to put a straitjacket on you and tell you this is how you're supposed to think. This is what you're allowed to say. This is what you're not allowed to say. This is what you're allowed to do, what you're not allowed to do. And if you follow the rules, you'll be rewarded. Mm-hmm. If you don't, you'll be punished.
They pretend that it's optional, but it's really compulsory, because if you don't do it, they come after you.
You'll be accused of harassment.
Churches turned away people with AIDS based on this supposed right, depriving those suffering from AIDS from needed care and basic respect. Arguments of sexual privacy and religious freedom then, naturally, emerged front and center in the Vatican's position on homosexuality and AIDS.
That's me in the corner.
In the 70s and 80s, Pope John Paul II, and by association the Vatican, were outwardly anti-homosexual, anti-premarital sex, and anti-sex with more than one partner. Pope John Paul II made his position very clear in 1979 when he gave his Address of His Holiness John Paul II to the bishops of the United States of America in Chicago, Illinois, on October 5th, 1979.
One of the few things not included in live coverage of the Pope's visit to Chicago was his address at Quigley South to 350 of the nation's bishops. It was perhaps the most controversial speech during his six-day American pilgrimage, a speech in which he informed the bishops that the Catholic Church will continue to oppose abortion, extramarital sex, homosexuality, and divorce.
In Chicago, Pope John Paul II said,
"In portraying the sexual union between husband and wife as a special expression of their covenanted love, you rightly stated, Sexual intercourse is a moral and human good only within marriage. Outside marriage, it is wrong. As men with the message of truth and the power of God, as authentic teachers of God's law and as compassionate pastors, you also rightly stated, homosexual activity, as distinguished from homosexual orientation, is morally wrong.
The church's position on homosexuality created a lot of tension and feeling of exclusion within gay churchgoers.
I am gay, and I believe in God, and I would like to believe and be part of a church. However, if the Catholic Church does not accept me and believes that my lifestyle is going to be the ruination of certain civilizations, then I don't need to be a part of this church.
The church's anti-homosexual position directly affected gay people during the AIDS crisis in the 80s, fostering negative sentiment towards homosexuals and ultimately creating a narrative that they were to be blamed for the crisis, as AIDS was seen as God's punishment for homosexuals. Michael Flynn's primary contributions to the AIDS crisis were through his work with Dignity USA. Founded in 1969, Dignity became one of the oldest Catholic organizations pushing for LGBTQIA+ advocacy within the Catholic Church. With a quickly emerging AIDS crisis impacting the LGBTQIA+ community, in 1981, Dignity quickly turned its attention to helping guide those diagnosed with AIDS spiritually and providing them with any aid they could. When hospital workers and clergy members would hesitate to go near patients diagnosed with AIDS, Dignity members would step in to provide them with food, company, clean laundry, cleaning services, and spiritual guidance. They also made it clear that their mission to address damaging statements made by the church, including then-Cardinal Ratzinger's Halloween letter.
And so when he makes a proclamation, and he was the number two guy in the Vatican, Dignity would have to step up. And Dignity would have to talk about these things.
Cardinal Ratzinger, or more commonly known as Pope Benedict XVI, published a letter titled Letter to the Bishops of the Catholic Church on the Pastoral Care of Homosexual Persons on October 1st, 1986. 1 month later, on October 31st, 1986, it was released to the public, thus dubbing it the Halloween Letter. Ratzinger's letter supported Pope John Paul II's position on homosexuality, stating,
"As in every moral disorder, homosexual activity prevents one's own fulfillment and happiness by acting contrary to the creative wisdom of God. The Church, in rejecting erroneous opinions regarding homosexuality, does not limit, but rather defends, personal freedom and dignity, realistically and authentically understood."
As expected, there were many criticisms of Ratzinger's letter. Some claimed support for its contents. However, unexpectedly, most Catholic Americans were upset by its contents. What was not known worldwide in the mid-80s was that the Vatican's main target in the United States was Dignity USA. The Halloween letter was published as a direct attack on members of Dignity.
And said, "You can't, this group," without naming us, this group, Dignity, says that we can be physically unitive. We actually came out and said, "You can have sex as an LGBT person and still be a person of God and still live the sacramental life of the church." And he was the one that came out and said, "No, you can't, and no bishop in the United States is allowed to have them on church property." Hmm. We weren't on church property, but Chicago was, New York was, every one of them were thrown out within 3 months.
This attack on Dignity USA came after Pope John Paul II had recently condemned two American church leaders, Fathers Charles Curran and Archbishop Raymond G. Huntsman. This letter was dubbed the final condemnation in the Bermuda Triangle of condemnation and left American Catholics upset, saying that Cardinal Ratzinger was,
"like the Red Baron, shooting down people who are different from him."
After the publication of the Halloween letter, Dignity doubled down on protesting for the rights of gay people and the Catholic Church.
The New York chapter of Dignity began to protest Cardinal O'Connor long before they started protesting the Halloween letter. Starting in 1976, Dignity would place a wreath at St. Patrick's during New York's annual Pride March to show that being gay and Catholic were not mutually exclusive. O'Connor often disagreed, though, stating,
"I have what we believe to be a truth, a moral absolute, to preach. that homosexual behavior, not an inclination, homosexual behavior is illicit. That's the teaching of the Catholic Church. I am a Catholic bishop.
Things changed when the Halloween letter came out. Prior to the Halloween letter, Dignity's New York chapter would meet in St. Francis Xavier Church. Due to the change in rules, they were kicked out of St. Francis Xavier, which led to their protests at St. Patrick's. On the first Sunday of every month, Dignity members would stand silently in the back of 1015 Mass. After a year of doing so, a court order blocked Dignity members from entering the church. As a response, they held monthly vigils at the same time on the sidewalk. They did so for 2 years. They called this the Cathedral Project. The Cathedral Project allowed churchgoers to attend Mass at St. Patrick's while still making their voices heard. Despite these vigils being unobstructive, it caused controversy within Dignity. In a reflection penned in 2012, Jeff Stone wrote,
"Not everyone agreed with the Cathedral Project, and understandably this was a period of great pain and division within the chapter. Some members formed another New York chapter, called Dignity Big Apple, which existed for more than a decade."
The Cathedral Project was controversial to some religious people because they disagreed with the mixture of religion and politics. They, like Michael, preferred to keep the two separate, focusing instead on more socially acceptable and polite forms of activism, like fundraisers. Some of these aid funds would be burial funds. Many people with AIDS in the 1980s went unclaimed or unacknowledged by their conservative families. This sometimes continued into their deaths, when families would, at best, hold a funeral where they refused to acknowledge their relatives' cause of death or sexuality. At worst, bodies went unclaimed and stayed at the city morgue. This happened to Nathaniel Frazier, a black gay man in his 20s who died from AIDS. In response, a fund was made in his name, the Nathaniel Frazier Burial Fund.
There was a kid that died of AIDS and his family wouldn't pick up the body. The family were, right-wing Christians. And this was also the time when some funeral directors were edgy about even, like, they would show up with gloves and masks and everything on.
Michael heard about this as the president of Dignity, as did the leader of Beth Ahava, a Jewish LGBT group, and MCC, the Metropolitan Community Church.
So the three of us got together with Mark, with Joe Fusco, and we buried this kid. Dignity Philadelphia later started the Nathaniel Frazier Burial Fund. Every now and then we would put some money into it, and we would... there was now an AIDS community. So we would go to the AIDS community or PWA community and say, do you know of anybody who needs to be buried or needs money?
Because of the stigma attached to AIDS, it was hard to find churches that were willing to hold services for AIDS victims. St. Luke's, an Episcopal church in Philadelphia, became the central point for a lot of AIDS activism because their doors were always open to PWAs. Chris Barlett writes,
"During the worst plague years of AIDS, Reverend Broadley sometimes had to preside over two funerals each weekend. St. Luke and the Epiphany conducted funerals for people of any religion because in the early days, many churches, synagogues, and mosques ostracized their gay members."
This form of activism appealed to moderates like Michael because there was no disruption taking place. No one could argue against services for the dead. The same could not be said for Stop the Church, which, as mentioned earlier, Michael was strongly against. In Michael's letter to Outweek, he tells a story of receiving a call about participating in the protest.
"Since I felt the planned Stop the Church demonstration to be pointless, and since I have seen plain unchristian hatred directed at O'Connor, I told the Saturday caller that I would not participate."
Michael, like many other Catholics and Christians at the time, believed that the accusations and criticisms of O'Connor for his response to AIDS were rooted in bigotry against Christians. This sentiment is echoed in the program Stop the Church, Issues and Outrage, which aired on KCET, a public television station in Los Angeles. This station aired a documentary around Stop the Church and was met with extreme backlash because people believed it to be unchristian. Cardinal Roger Mahoney said,
"That KCET would capitulate to the terrorist-like demands of a very few extremists at the expense of the Catholic people and others who share many of our values is the height of irresponsibility."
The documentary itself captures the days leading up to the protests, as well as some reactions from the attendance of the mass. The sentiments expressed at this point encapsulate the conservative response to Stop the Church.
I don't approve of such goings-on in a holy place.
Blasphemous is the word. I think it's unfortunate that people like that think that people like myself are not intelligent enough to make their own decisions to know that this is how we sincerely feel.
If they would behave themselves, they would get into this mess.
This church continues to teach what it's taught for 2,000 years, and that's sodomy and abortion are evil.
Because of the backlash to these protests, and because of their own political beliefs, many moderates during the AIDS crisis believed in a quieter, subtler approach to AIDS activism. They preferred socially acceptable activism, the kind that didn't make waves or disrupt the peace, so organizations like ACT UP were deemed radical and often decried by these.
Activism and advocacy for gay rights looked different across varying organizations. While some vied for complete sexual and social liberations, others felt the situation called for a meet conservatives where they are at approach. A third, more radical form of activism came from ACT UP, which loudly demanded for government intervention that would finally treat AIDS as the epidemic it was and develop a cure.
This beautiful day started with trouble in Lower Manhattan. More than 100 people were arrested during a protest. Demonstrators were demanding more money in the war against AIDS. They brought rush hour traffic to a standstill. Tim Minton has details.
ACT UP protesters were explicitly concerned with making themselves aware to the public too. Too loud and disruptive for the government to ignore. With chapters across the country, ACT UP prioritized actions that would disrupt daily lives, such as blocking traffic on Wall Street, die-ins held outside the FDA headquarters, and protesting on church grounds.
Police have been prepared for waves of protesters, and that's exactly what happened. As fast as they could take one group off the streets, another group sat down, and Broadway was blocked for more than an hour.
As we mentioned, the Stop the Church protest organized by ACT UP was perhaps one of their more prolific and controversial modes of protest. While ACT UP had primarily targeted its message towards the government and policy change, the organization pivoted to the challenge of the church when leaders openly condemned condom usage. To ACT UP, this was one of the most dangerous wrenches thrown in the fight against the AIDS pandemic. In response, they organized the infamous protest at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City. The American public finding this protest offensive likely doesn't surprise listeners. Even members of the ACT UP organization had trouble getting on board with it.
There was a lot of concern as to whether or not it was really appropriate for us to do a demonstration at the church.
Tensions over the protest stems from the fact that at the time, New York City chapter's members' makeup was roughly 30% Catholic raised. There were members who felt it was a personal attack on the parishioners, while others were more concerned with the public backlash and how it would set back the progress they've made.
I'm Sarah Shulman. I was sitting in a pew and I watched the die-in, which I think was pretty effective. But when people from ACT UP started standing on pews and screaming, it really alienated the people who were praying. I saw people get very angry and upset. I think they felt really violated by that.
Even among the more radical and progressive groups like ACT UP, respectability and privacy policies had yet again played a role in intimidating organizers to protest in a respectful, digestible manner. And while we hail them as heroes today, their actions at the time were seen as largely disrespectful and asking for too much, especially among the conservative right. Throughout this podcast series, we've set out to challenge the widespread belief that religion and gay identities don't mix. Similarly, Michael Flynn challenges the myth that gay people are inherently liberal or left-leaning. In fact, Michael Flynn's conservatism represents a larger unspoken phenomenon of how gay men see their identities in relation to their civic and political viewpoints.
Being gay, for me, is just a small part of me. I think gay Republicans, they tend to subsume their sexuality when it comes to making political votes.
Young has researched the narrative that gay men are inherently behind more progressive movements and views. He dispels the notion that the gay community is one big monolith that thinks the same, simultaneously establishing that for many gay men, their sexual identity is an afterthought, not inherent to who they are.
I'm a Christian, a patriotic American, and a free market, shrink the government conservative, who also happens to be gay. What I mean by that is, my values define me.
So why bring up the topic of gay conservatives at all? As we seek to understand how the narrative of religion versus homosexuality came to be, we can also try to explore the similar formation of conservatism versus homosexuality, especially as it relates to someone like Michael Flynn. For Michael Flynn, the advocacy of gay rights within the church and his work through Dignity USA was not political, focusing on direct community care and adhering to privacy and respectability politics. This is important for acknowledging and understanding the nuances behind how different organizations mobilized during the AIDS crisis. When exploring how different religious leaders sought to address the epidemic, it lends knowledge to how some saw it as an issue of gay rights issue, and others saw it as merely a public health issue, and some just wanted to ignore it altogether. Stick around for our next episode on Guy Weston, a prominent Christian gay figure who was especially concerned with the public health issue and the study of the disease that wreaked havoc on Philadelphia's many communities.